Today is Friday, July 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, tensions continue to rise between the U.S. and Iran after Washington says it shot down a drone.
The drone was immediately destroyed. This is the latest of many provocative and hostile actions.
Tension, and 50 years ago today, Apollo 11 arrived in orbit around the moon. But how did NASA choose where to land? Those stories and more are coming up on today's International Edition. A U.S. naval vessel in the Strait of Hormuz shot down an Iranian drone, that according to President Donald Trump.
The drone was immediately destroyed. This is the latest of many provocative and hostile actions by Iran against vessels operating in international waters.
I recently spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman for the latest on this escalation of tension between the United States and Iran.
The president indicated that the USS Boxer shot down an Iranian drone yesterday, but Iran has come out and said the drone wasn't it. What is the latest information that the administration has put out asserting its position?
Well, I was in a background briefing on Friday morning with some senior U.S. officials, and one of them stated blatantly, we have very clear evidence that this amphibious assault ship in the Strait of Hormuz shot down the Iranian drone. The official saying we would anticipate there's video that will probably be released at some point by the Department of Defense. Noted how the Iranians don't have a great history with the truth, and that they have a 40-year history of provoking the United States.
Now, this is all coming at a time when tensions are escalating and Iran has impounded a vessel last weekend as well. Has the administration said anything about the freedom of navigation through the strait?
Well, that has been a message that this administration and previous administrations have repeatedly emphasized, that there has to be freedom of navigation through the strait. And if anything is done to block that with both military and commercial vessels, then most certainly the United States is going to ensure that there is a free flow of maritime traffic.
One last thing. Iran has said it is willing to have discussions with the United States and even allow inspections of its facilities if it were to let up on sanctions. What has been the latest from the administration on possible talks between Tehran and Washington?
Yes, Steve, that was something that was floated by the foreign minister of Iran, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who is in New York. He's pretty limited to sticking around the United Nations due to visa restrictions. And that's being brushed off by the officials I was speaking with today. And what they're saying is if Iran is really serious about this, then they need to first start by ending uranium enrichment immediately and having an actual decision maker attempt to negotiate a deal. And they're saying Zarif is definitely not that person, that any offer needs to come from either the Iran Hassan Rouhani.
Steve Herman is VOA's bureau chief at the White House. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Steve.
A lawyer for former South African President Jacob Zuma told a corruption inquiry on Friday that Zuma would not take part in the inquiry further because he felt that he was being questioned unfairly, but then reversed his decision. Earlier, I spoke with VOA South Africa Bureau Chief Anita Powell and asked her to explain why Zuma initially withdrew from the proceedings.
So to really understand what's going on, you have to look back a few days. President Zuma has spent 3 days on the stand at the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture. And throughout, he has said that he's been treated unfairly. He's been harshly cross-examined. And then, of course, the other side, the prosecutor, says, well, your memory is spotty and you're a poor witness. Throughout, Zuma said things like, oh, I don't recall, I don't remember, about things that happened, you know, a short amount of time ago, whereas he flawlessly remembers details stretching back decades. So there's a lot of tension at this commission of inquiry. He definitely does feel like he has been put on the spot And his lawyers are now saying enough is enough. You're going outside the mandate of the commission's mandate, and so we're not going to participate.
So where do we go from here now that Zuma has said he's going to participate at least in some way?
Well, I think the big question is, what is it going to mean? Are we going to actually get any answers from Jacob Zuma? He's now changed his mind. He says he will return. We don't know when. But he's also said that his return will be on his own terms, which probably what that means is that they're going to try to redefine the terms under which they can ask him questions. Given his testimony so far, which, as I said, has been vague, and that's maybe the nicest thing one could say about it, it's been vague, I'm not sure what more we will get out of this in terms of answers from Jacob Zuma. He seems not in a position to give definitive answers that will unravel this big mystery in South Africa.
Given that it's somewhat unknown how cooperative Zuma may be, what can the Commission of Inquiry do?
So it has limited scope and it has limited powers. It can recommend criminal prosecution based on its findings. And it is looking into a pretty specific set of events. And so it can make recommendations for prosecution related to those significant events, which would, of course, take a long time. This isn't an overnight thing. The National Prosecuting Authority will take a little while to actually act on those. So a big question is, this commission is about halfway through 2 years of work, and what can it do? That's a really big question that South Africans are asking. They're not feeling especially confident.
And that was VOA South Africa Bureau Chief Anita Powell speaking to me from Johannesburg. A strong earthquake hit Friday near the Greek capital of Athens, causing residents to run to the streets in fear and firefighters to check for people trapped in elevators. Athens Institute of Geodynamics gave the earthquake a preliminary magnitude of 5.1, but the U.S. Geological Survey gave it a preliminary magnitude of 5.3. The Civil Protection Authority said there was no immediate word on injuries or damage, but that police and volunteers north of the capital were carrying out searches for possible damage. And here are some other major stories from around the globe. Japan's foreign minister summoned South Korea's ambassador Friday because South Korea has not entered arbitration to settle a dispute about World War II-era forced labor. Officials say a blast at a university in Afghanistan's capital of Kabul has killed 2 people and wounded 10 others. Bangladesh wants Myanmar to repatriate the nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees who fled genocide. And a top Bangladeshi official wants international finance sanctions to back it up. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com or with our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A 2017 market research report suggests people around the world spend about $132.8 billion each year on dietary supplements such as vitamins and minerals. An enormous new analysis involving about 10 U.S. universities and medical institutions, 277 clinical trials, and almost 1 million research participants suggests that almost all vitamin, mineral, and other nutrient supplements or diets cannot be connected to longer life or protection from heart disease. The analysis shows only a low-salt diet, omega-3 fatty acid supplements, and perhaps folic acid for some might provide possible health benefits. The study also found that while most of the supplements weren't harmful, a combination of calcium and vitamin D might be linked to a slightly increased risk of stroke. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. It has been a trying week for American democracy. U.S. President Donald Trump has come under fire for verbal attacks on 4 minority Democratic congresswomen. The House of Representatives, largely along party lines, voted to condemn some of the president's comments as racist. At the same time, opposition Democrats remain divided over whether to try and impeach President Trump or focus on defeating him in next year's presidential election. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone takes a look at it from here.
Before an enthusiastic crowd in North Carolina, President Trump unleashed yet another attack on four Democrats in Congress, all women of color.
These left-wing ideologues see our nation as a force of evil, the way they speak so badly of our country. They want to demolish our Constitution, weaken our military, eliminate the values that built this magnificent country.
At one point in his rally, the president targeted Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, prompting chants of "send her back" from the crowd. Trump's combative appearance came on the same day the House voted to set aside an effort by some Democrats to initiate impeachment proceedings against him. But earlier in the week, the House did take the unusual step of voting to condemn some of Trump's attacks on the four lawmakers as racist. All House Democrats supported the resolution, including civil rights icon John Lewis of Georgia.
I know racism when I see it. I know racism when I feel it. And at the highest level of government, there's no room for racism.
President Trump's victory in 2016 was spurred by strong support from white working class voters. But many Democrats believe the president is now making a dangerous bid for support based on racial resentment, including Congressman Tom Malinowski.
These words are not just words. They are like gasoline. They are like a spark to the gasoline of disturbed minds.
Trump denies he's a racist, but he has slammed the four congresswomen as socialists and urged them to leave the country if they are unhappy. Some Republicans have complained about the attacks, but many others, including Senator John Kennedy, support the president.
This is not China. This is not North Korea. This is America. And if you hate our country, you're free to leave anytime you want to.
The president's raw focus on racial and ideological strains is tearing at the fabric of the country, warns Democratic Congressman Dean Phillips.
And if racism ever becomes a partisan issue in this country, we have done a woeful disservice to our founders. We have done a woeful disservice to our Constitution and a woeful disservice to every single person that calls America home.
The president's narrow victory in 2016 and his relatively low approval rating leaves him vulnerable for re-election, says analyst Kyle Connor.
If his approval rating is under 45, then he's going to need a significant share of people who don't approve of him to vote for him, and that's when it becomes really difficult.
This week's rhetorical fireworks likely serve as a preview for what could be an ugly and volatile presidential campaign next year. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Papua New Guinea's new prime minister has called on Australia Friday to set a deadline for relocating several hundred refugees and asylum seekers who have been stranded in his country since the closure of a migrant camp. Phil Mercer has that story.
The Manus Island Detention Center closed in October 2017 after judges in Papua New Guinea said it was unconstitutional. About 450 former detainees remain on the island, in community housing or in the capital Port Moresby. Most are refugees who've been told by the government in Canberra that as part of uncompromising border policies, they'll never be allowed to be resettled in Australia. Few have any desire to stay in Papua New Guinea, but their presence in the impoverished country is putting pressure on health services and fueling tensions with local residents. Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape wants senior Australian ministers to set a timetable for the men to be removed.
I've met Immigration Minister Peter Dutton already. I've asked him to expedite the process of facing up issues of asylum seekers. We need to have established a timeline going forward. genuine refugees and there are also non-genuine refugees. What happens to the residual we have in countries? These are human beings we're dealing with. We can't leave them all hanging in space with no serious consideration to their future.
6 years ago, Australia started its policy of sending all asylum seekers caught trying to reach the country by sea to offshore camps on Manus Island and the tiny Pacific Republic of Nauru. They were told they would never be allowed into Australia, even as genuine refugees. Australia has argued that the risk of being sent to a camp in the South Pacific has been a powerful deterrent, stopping migrants making the perilous sea crossing on rickety fishing boats from Indonesia. Rights groups have consistently claimed conditions in the camps were cruel and inhumane. The United States has resettled about 500 refugees from the facilities under an asylum deal with Australia. About 350 asylum seekers remain on Nauru. Merape is due to arrive in Australia Sunday on his first overseas trip as Prime Minister and will spend a week meeting with government officials. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the African Continental Free Trade Area is now a reality that, if successful, will create a $3.4 trillion economic bloc. A closer look at Africa's free trade agreement on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Do the policies and rhetoric of the Trump administration alleviate or exacerbate the immigration crisis along the U.S. southern border? On this edition of Encounter, Cristobal Ramon, senior policy analyst at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Ariel G. Ruiz Soto, associate policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, discuss the substance and politics of the immigration crisis with host Carol Castiel. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on Encounter.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. It was 50 years ago today that Apollo 11 and its astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Edwin Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins, went into orbit around the moon. But how did NASA decide where the Apollo missions would actually land? For that, I earlier spoke with Dr. Farouk L. Baz, retired director of remote sensing at Boston University, but more importantly, he was part of the NASA team that actually chose the landing sites. I began our conversation by asking Dr. L. Baz how he wound up working for NASA.
Well, Steve, it's very interesting because at that time, I was looking for a job, and I came to this country in the fall of 1966, and I started looking for a job, and all of my connections with universities did not work because I hired people to teach for the fall semesters, and there was nothing immediate that I could get, and I thought, here is an ad in Physics Today. They were looking for geologists to help NASA headquarters think about the moon.
So if I understand you correctly, yeah. You got involved with NASA just because you came to the United States simply at the wrong time of year?
That's correct. It was a total happenstance. I was looking for a job, and NASA headquarters was looking for some geologists to assist them.
So what happened next?
I applied, and I went for an interview. And lo and behold, the guy that met me for the interview was by the name of Edmund Nixon, the brother of Richard Nixon, the president.
Mm-hmm.
He himself was a geologist. And we talked, and I went for the rest of the interviews, and I was two weeks later, they sent me a letter confirming that they want me to start in March of 1967.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, when you were at NASA, of course, this is the time during multiple moon landings were scheduled. And you, as I understand it, had a role in helping to identify locations on the surface of the moon to touch down and working with the astronauts to kind of do the scientific research up there.
That's correct. And maybe what helped me greatly was the fact that I did not know a thing about the moon, and that in itself encouraged me and pushed me to gain as much knowledge as I possibly can, and I intended to do that more than the other guys, some 60 geologists that were working for the U.S. Geological Survey up under NASA contract. So here is a whole bunch of geologists, nearly 60, that were working on the program for years, and here I come. I don't know anything about the moon yet. I had to work very hard, and I accumulated as much knowledge, and I started doing things before they even did, and I told them about it, and they began to ask me questions, and I became, and lo and behold, in a few months, I became the source of information for them, because I really did do my homework.
So what was one of the things that you identified that NASA wasn't doing that enabled you to become that expert?
First of all, classifying all the surface features. I asked myself, if we're going to go to the moon, where would you go to see all the different types of features, which means that we would sample all the different kinds of lunar rocks? That question had never been really asked. So I asked it myself. And after I looked at all of the images that came from from lunar orbiter before Apollo, they were over 2,000 pictures. I looked at them all, studied them thoroughly, and I summarized each and every one. I had 2,000 pieces of cards that summarized everything. And then when I asked myself, where do we go? I looked at all of these things, and I found that there were 16 places. If we went to them, we would have seen all the different types of features on the moon, and therefore we would have sampled every kind of rock on the moon if we see all the features.
So as someone who actually worked with identifying the landing sites for the Apollo missions, what was it like watching the events unfold as Apollo 11 was looking to touch down?
Well, with Apollo 11, we were concerned because the spacecraft did not go where we selected.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was an increase in the velocity during the separation between the lunar module and the command module. And that was not accounted for by the engineers at NASA at the time, and therefore the landing craft was heading further west from the point that we selected, and that's why Neil Armstrong had to take over and maneuver himself and move to land in a safer place. And therefore, on the Apollo 12 mission, the objective of one of the main objectives of the mission was called pinpoint landing, meaning that we geologists selected the landing site, then the engineers had to make absolutely certain that they land the craft, or they designed the craft to land exactly on the spot that we selected.
And that was Dr. Farouk Elbaz, retired director of remote sensing at Boston University, and of course, part of the Apollo team of scientists. And before I go, let's take a quick look back in time. It was on this date in 1848, a women's right convention in Seneca Falls, New York, launched the movement to give American women the right to vote. That campaign succeeded when the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution took effect more than 70 years later. And in 1980, the Summer Olympics started in Moscow. Minus the United States and dozens of other countries, those countries decided to boycott the Games over the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan. And in 1985, Christina McAuliffe from New Hampshire was chosen to be the first school teacher to ride aboard the space shuttle. She and six other crew members died in the Challenger explosion shortly after liftoff in January of 1986. And that's going to do it for me today. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, engineer, Nick Ivanov, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson,
Thank you so much for joining us. Now for pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a fantastic Friday and an amazing weekend.